Hello and welcome to Culture with me, Robert Bound, where today we're asking, why are books in translation such big business? 2 weeks ago, it was announced by Nielsen Book that in 2015, sales of translated literature represented 5% of all fiction sold in the UK. That's a 96% rise since 2001. So today, we're going to be talking to some industry experts to find out why readers and publishers have a growing thirst for international reads. I'll be joined in the studio by commissioning editor at Granta and Porter Bello Books, Anne Meadows, and foreign rights agent for David Godwin Associates, Lisette Verhagen. Plus, we'll hear from Man Booker Prize winning translator Deborah Smith, and we'll take a trip to meet the people behind a publishers and bookshop in Dallas with a multicultural mindset. That's all ahead on today's episode of Culture with me, Robert Bound. Do stay tuned. And without further ado, Anne and Lisette, welcome to the programme. First of all, it's an interesting topic. We need to take it to bits, I think, for our listeners. Lisette, as advertised in our introduction, we said that you handle foreign rights at David Godwin Associates, which is a literary agent. So what do you do all day? What happens? Do transcripts come across your desk, particularly things that have been translated from wherever they're from into English, and you have to judge their saleability? What happens in foreign rights?
Well, I do actually two different things. Like, one of the things I do is selling UK authors to abroad. Uh-huh. So to all different territories. That could be Brazil, that could be Germany, which is always really good if you have Germany on board, but Holland as well. And then the other thing I'm also doing, and that's because we are now working for the same company, but it's another different literary agency in Paris, is Susanna Lee Associates. And they have a lot of French authors, but also like Danish authors, very, I think, a little bit more European. And I sell those to the UK market or together with my colleagues. So they're two different things. It's a lot harder to sell European authors to the UK market than the other way around. And one of the main reasons is that, of course, people cannot, or publishers cannot read them, not every language. So what we do is we really work on a whole package. We have to make sure that there is a good sample translation. And a translation, sometimes it's only a few chapters, but to make sure that it covers like the whole idea of the book, that the publishers can get that. And then also we try to get as much information about the author as possible. And we need to back it up with sale figures in all the countries where it has been published before, because normally a book is already published in other countries before it goes to the UK.
So you've got a problem and you've got a solution. You've got a problem in that maybe people think, oh, there's a French writer, will I like that? Will it be something else? Will it be too literary, perhaps? People have snobberies and instincts about places that they think authors are from, perhaps ways in which certain countries write. But I suppose in the plus column, in the credit column, you have the fact that this writer has a back catalogue, or certainly has a track record and has been well reviewed in Denmark or in Paris. Is that kind of how it works? You have to weigh these
exactly.
things up.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. It's exactly how it works. And sometimes, I mean, a really good Danish newspaper doesn't really, it's not always translates to the UK market because they just don't know the paper. So you need a lot more information to convince. And what really helps is if you have other good publishers around the world on board. So if you can see, well, there is a really good German publisher, for example, Hanser is a very literary publisher. If you get him on board, they talk to more people. So it's not only the agent who can do, of course, we try as much as we can, but what really helps if you have other publishers who talk to other publishers, and especially at a book fair in Frankfurt or here at the London Book Fair, that is really the best thing that can happen to a book, if other publishers talk to each other about the books they bought, and then that a UK publisher or an American publisher decides, oh, I really want to translate this into English.
So half of it is getting the literary credentials in place and placing a really good manuscript,
exactly.
A really good book with a British publisher or an English language publisher, I guess I should say. And another half is just good old buzz, right? It's getting people talking about it. And your commissioning editor at Granta and Porter Bello, just a cursory Google will tell people that there's a lot of works in translation. There's a lot of foreign named authors for a publisher based in good old Holland Park here in London. Does Lisette's story sound very familiar to you, that it's halfway house between the quality of the book and the buzz around it?
Yes, absolutely. I think what really comes across in what Lisette was saying was that a lot of it's passion. You know, you have an agent who's telling you ignore the fact that this is like a translated novel about a woman who wants to turn into a plant, for example, which is what The Vegetarian, who's just won the Man Booker Prize, is about, and says, this is extraordinary. This is the book that you should pin your hopes on. And you listen to all of that and you look at the reviews if you can. And if you have a translated sample or a translator who's very passionate, you listen to them. And gradually you build up this picture of, you know, how this book, how you would take this book out and you would say to bookstores and you would say to readers, take a risk on this one, because I think there is still a hesitancy in UK readers about fiction and translation. And, you know, I have friends who tell me they don't read translated fiction, which I find bizarre, because translated fiction is just fiction that has come from another country in another language. There's nothing particular about it that should put you off, but people are still a little nervous.
Well, before we move on then, let's address that question, because that's an interesting one. What is their hang-up? Is it that they want to kind of bore down into the real soul of the author somehow, and they feel that a translation is a remove away from the original intention? Or do they just think, well, there's enough English writers? What's the reason? Or do they maybe just think it's going to be tricky subject matter?
I think there are a couple of things. I think sometimes if a translation is done badly, it's an agonizing thing for a reader. I think translation is such an incredible skill. It's like a form of alchemy. You're taking a work and you're sort of allowing it almost as a translator to, I mean, this makes it sound mystical and it's not, it's hard work, but you're sort of allowing it to pass through you and into your language. And so it's not quite your book, but at the same time, you're entirely responsible for it working and for every word that you've chosen and pieced together. And translators are very, very dedicated and hardworking and intelligent and often lyrical people. So if all those things don't come together and the book doesn't quite get that magic, then it's not really going to work. And then people get put off in the same way that some people get put off poetry, you know, when they do their GCSEs. I think some people read a poor translation and think, oh God, what have I done? What have I invested my time in? And I think the other reason that there's still a hesitancy, I don't think it's about drilling down into the soul of the author so much as it is just that for a while, and I think this has changed, for a while, fiction and translation was marketed as though it was going to be very serious and good for you.
Yeah.
And it was going to educate you and it was going to maybe...
That's right. There's a bit of fear factor about how serious it might be.
Yeah.
Right?
It seemed kind of snobby or for the elite, which again is totally ridiculous. And I think the last 10 years, there have been so many success stories of books like Haruki Murakami is just fun to read. His novels are wonderful.
And presumably all the Henning Mankell books. There's so many things that are humongously popular just happen that they're written in Swedish or Japanese, exactly.
Precisely.
Right? We're going to hear from a translator now, and one who's been making headlines recently. Deborah Smith is a London-based translator who deals in Korean literature. 2 weeks ago, she and South Korean author Han Kang took home the Man Booker International Prize for Kang's beautifully written novel, The Vegetarian. Monocle's Andrew Muller meets Deborah to find out about the delicate process of transforming someone's words into another language and her relationship with Kang throughout the process.
2013 was when I first read her book. I hadn't met her before then. I wasn't really in the translation or the publishing industry, but I read her book. I translated some of it. I was sort of sent it through a series of publishing connections, and she was being promoted at that time by her agent, Barbara Zitwer, who's based in New York, and who was doing a lot of work getting UK publishers interested in her. It had been translated into a lot of other languages already. I read it, I did a sample. Barbara sealed the deal with Max Porter at Portobello Books, and that was that.
Han Kang, I think I'm right in saying, speaks English herself.
Yes, she does.
So what did she think a translator could bring to the text that she couldn't?
Well, I mean, obviously she doesn't speak English anywhere to the level of a fluent native speaker, or indeed beyond that, to someone who would necessarily be able to translate. And also, a lot of authors, even who are completely bilingual, they feel like they don't have the distance to the original text that's necessary to be able to, you know, make sometimes hard decisions in terms of how to really make it live in another language.
Is there a laid down template or a process that you follow for this, or did you both make it up as you went along?
I was definitely making it up as I went along. I had no idea what I was doing. And the idea of actually having a contract and a deadline was a bit terrifying to me. So I sort of locked myself away and went at it as hard and fast as possible, and actually ended up completing it several months ahead of the deadline, which was apparently completely unheard of.
That makes you a publishing phenomenon in itself, as I'm sure you've been told. How did it work, though? Was it collaborative as you went along, or did you just do large bunches of it and then send them to her and say, is this okay?
It wasn't collaborative at the very beginning because I had no contact details for her. And because it was, you know, my first gig, I didn't know what the usual process was. I didn't know whether I should ask somebody to put her in touch with me. So I went away, did it, then sent it to Max Porter, who's the editor. He went through that really meticulously. And then he sent it to her because he knew that she could read English. I didn't at that point. And then Kang herself, she went through it again incredibly carefully and made a lot of really detailed notes, sent it back to me, and then we sort of went back and forth from there.
What was the nature of those notes? Were there any points of conflict or confusion or things where you thought one thing said one thing and she thought it said another?
Not really. I mean, generally, they were notes for her to explain a little bit more about her intention, what she'd been hoping to achieve with a particular passage or a character. Obviously, there were some points as well where she was explaining particular sort of cultural things that I maybe wouldn't have picked up on. And if there were, I think pretty much from all those instances, that was useful information to me. I then went back and reworked the translation in the light of that.
That was nice to listen to, wasn't it? Deborah Smith, the translator there of The Vegetarian by Han Kang. And that book is out now, published by Portobello Books, as is her more recent novel, Human Acts. Talking of Portobello Books, Anne Meadows is here, who's commissioning editor at the publisher. So you must have seen that happening, kind of live, as it were. It's an interesting one, isn't it? I wondered particularly, it was interesting, Andrew Miller there asking Deborah about the fact that she, the author and the translator, had no contact. Now, is that a tactic used by publishers to get the job done?
It's not a tactic. As an editor, you're responsible for the book in its English language form, and you're responsible for making sure that what you have is the best possible version of the novel and for going out with that. So the way that most of us tend to work with translators is that we will look over the translation and edit it and make suggestions, just using, you know, the like Deborah was saying, using your fluency in English. And sometimes translators, I mean, translation is so impossibly difficult. I have such admiration for Deborah and for everyone who undertakes it. And I think when you're in the midst of it and when you're trying to think essentially in two languages at once, sometimes your cadences come out sounding slightly odd, or sometimes you won't realize that a particular sentence or a particular way of describing something seems slightly bizarre, whereas your editor hopefully will, and we'll pick up on that and we'll be able to smooth it and think about it. And then questions for the author come next. I think that that's pretty standard, although some translators do work directly with the authors, but then sometimes the editor has to come in later and go over all those questions again. So it's just best practice.
I guess there's the point also at which you're trying not to smooth out a style too much to make it, well, the style of the editor, but even the style of what he thinks the author's voice should be, when actually it's not faithful to the perhaps strange jumpy prose that it's strange jumpy prose in, for example, Korean, for a point, and you're smoothing it out by putting it into English or French or Japanese, for example.
Well, faithful is a really hot question in translation. I mean, what is it to be faithful? Is it to retain a sense of linguistic difference, for someone to be almost able to feel that the language is a little bit strange, or like you say, the cadences are rough, or sometimes even to keep certain terms in the original language? Or is it faithful to give the reader the experience that a Korean reader would have, which would be that these things felt by and large normal and smooth? I think it's Dostoevsky, the word on the street is that Dostoevsky in Russian is an entirely different reading experience to Dostoevsky in English, and that's because presumably the translators into English have made certain decisions about smoothing and about faithfulness.
It's a fascinating thing. It's a can of worms in a way, isn't it?
It is a can
because you
of
could
worms.
Never you can it kind of can never end. Lizette, I guess choosing translators is also part of your business. You say you try to find a good translation, as in a decent translation, in order to get English language publishers to read this foreign book. What does that entail?
Well, it's a totally different. It's a totally different level because
you're casting your net a bit wider, I guess.
Exactly, and yeah. For us, it's more the idea. First of all, we have to work a lot quicker. It's just a sample, and a lot of publishers, if they buy it, if they are convinced and want to publish the book, they will go for their own translators. And so we are not looking for like the perfect translator, but we do want a translator that can get the feel of the book and across to the publisher. But it's also very expensive. I think a lot of readers might not know like how expensive it is to really translate a book. So in the early stage, if we're not sure yet that it's published, it's the author or the agency paying for the translation. So it's often a job like people do it out of love for the text.
You recommended the novels of Herman Koch, a Dutch writer, to me. Does he write in Dutch and in English, or
just in Dutch?
So, okay, just so this is the thing. I was interested in this. I'm reading his book that's going to be coming out in August at the moment, and you recommended The Dinner to me and Summer House with Swimming Pool by him. And I've been wondering sort of how he comes across in Dutch. As someone that's fluent in both those languages, what's he like in each language?
I think the translation really captures it really well. But he's, for example, in Holland, he is very funny. Like, he is also known for lots of TV shows where he's a very funny character. So his writing, really, you can see it in his writing as well. So for me, it's very Dutch because it's very direct, a bit blunt and funny. But I'm not so sure how people here in the UK or even in the United States, where I think the book is even bigger, how they feel it. But it must be a different experience.
I mean, to me, I think they're funny books. They're charming books, but I feel that it is a joke that has been translated rather than a joke being told in its original language. I kind of get the feeling it's been translated, if you know what I mean, which is a kind of funny thing, isn't it?
Is that a good thing? I'm not sure if that was really...
Well, I don't know. You definitely feel like you're reading a book in translation. We'll just have to tell our listeners to go off and buy a Herman Koch book and see what they think, I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a really good idea.
But it is a funny thing. And I wonder about, in both of your experiences, actually, the relationship between, I mean, Deborah Smith and Han Kang seem to have perhaps an unusual relationship in that they didn't have one until almost the book had been finished in translation. But what, I suppose, Anne, you'd be best placed to answer this, is the relationship between the translator and the novelist like generally, because presumably it can get pretty intense.
I think it can. I know a lot of people who are very good friends with their translators. Mm. One of our authors, Patrick DeWitt, I think his French translator is maybe even the godfather to his child, or vice versa. You know,
well, so that's a wonderful and analogous situation, isn't it?
It is a wonderful analogous situation. I think one of our authors, Hiromi Kawakami, once told me that we published a novel by her called Strange Weather in Tokyo in 2013. And it had been published in Japanese in 2001. So it had been a full decade between the two publications. And I asked her how it felt to have her book come out in a new language so much later. And she said it was like when your son brings home a girlfriend, you know? So I think there's a familial metaphor running through all of translation.
It seems like that.
Yeah.
Okay, so we are trying to answer the question, why are books in translation such big business? And we're going to hop across the pond now to meet the people behind Deep Vellum, a not-for-profit publisher and bookshop based in Dallas that seeks to connect the world's greatest contemporary writers with English-speaking readers. And Monocle contributor Lindsay Connect reports.
Though his business is new fiction, Will Evans keeps a place for the grandfathers of Russian literature. They're in ink all over his arms.
Pushkin and Gogol are toasting cups of coffee and declaring a toast, and then there's a quote by Mayakovsky that says, in English, the sun would dim upon seeing the golden fields of our souls, which I just love. It's a beautiful line. I love Mayakovsky, the romantic, beautiful poet.
Something else about Will's arms, he can't keep them still. The resurgence of alt-lit is felt in his shop and office, with its lofted ceilings and bay windows that look out onto street art. And it's felt in the catalog he's put together for Deep Vellum, all new fiction and translation by writers like Indonesia's Leila Hudori and Mexico's Carmen Boyosa.
I don't think I could have founded this press 5 years ago and sold the number of books that we have. Actually, we're in a second edition of one of our books and a third edition of another, and about to print second editions of two or three more. And that's like many thousands of books. That's crazy. That's a good time to be alive. And when you look at like our most successful titles, they are not plot driven, you know, get you at the end type of fiction. They are like extremely literary, like stylistically innovative.
Will swam against advice from friends in New York who said the landscape in Dallas would be barren of adventurous readers and supporters. he found a haven for the imprint's brand in the Deep Ellum neighborhood, with its rich artistic inheritance that goes back to the blues era, when musicians like Leadbelly and Blind Lemon Jefferson called the area home. Will named the press Deep Vellum and tied his project to the neighborhood.
Yeah, come on in.
Kendra Green sits at a folding table in the back of the shop. She's the manager and the writer-in-residence at the Dallas Museum of Art. She specializes in Icelandic language and culture. Between visitors here, she's absorbed in a copy of the Nobel Prize-winning oral history Voices of Chernobyl from the shelves. Though the press offers fiction, patrons of the Deep Vellum shop wander into a selection of translated nonfiction and poetry as well.
We're beta testing hours this week. So I have a theory that sometime between noon and 7, there's a sweet spot. Eventually, we'd like to be open forever, right, to have people start their mornings with us and to come for evening events, to hang out here before they go meet their friends for drinks.
The challenge to create a social habit around reading is not new. Will goes further with this, though, in getting people together to confront uncomfortable realities about America's place in the larger worlds accessible through Deep Vellum fiction. For example, he partnered recently with the world-lit-friendly Oak Cliff bookstore Wild Detectives and the Alamo Drafthouse cinema chain to screen a documentary in tandem with the writer's visit.
We have an Indonesian author, Leila Hudori, who wrote a novel about the 1965 massacre of alleged communists in Indonesia. Over 1 million people died. The coup that led to these 1 million people was backed by the CIA. And so, like, we have a hand in this. Our hands are bloody. My understanding of her story came from seeing The Act of Killing, which I saw many years before this. And so that was my introduction to that piece of Indonesian history, this tragedy. And so when we brought the author to Dallas just in April, so just last month, we did a screening of the follow-up, The Look of Silence. And then Leila discussed this movie, its reception in Indonesia, how it portrays Indonesian history and her work and where it comes from. And so it was a free screening at the Alamo Drafthouse downtown. And we had, you know, 50, 60 people there watching this movie. And then just an author who was talking about her work and kind of like giving perspective to it. We weren't there just to hawk books, you know. It was about this whole experience outside of that.
Still, Deep Vellum attracts the sort of reader who needs no coaxing to enter the worlds brought to them in a book.
Hi, my name is Nan Ho, and I've read 6 Deep Vellum titles this year.
Nan travels often as an IT worker in the healthcare industry. He says he reads in bars and hotels, and when he's at home near Dallas, while walking his German Shepherd, book in one hand, leash in the other. His first reference for the situation in Indonesia was Hudori's book, Home.
Her book manages to capture what it means to be a political exile in France, being a victim of the regime in Indonesia. Here you're feeling the sorrow, the yearning for home, and the yearning for the world that they used to know. And that's powerful.
Getting to the core of that power, of course, is the work of the translator. Shelby Vincent, who's based at the University of Texas at Dallas, saw the depth of her interaction with an author's mind on the page in a strange way for a project to be published by Deep Vellum in December.
The book is Cielos de la Tierra by Carmen Bullosa. In the novel, there are 3 different time periods: early colonial Mexico, kind of contemporary Mexico, and then a post-apocalyptic future. And in each of the time periods, the main character is a translator. And they are all, in fact, basically translating the same text. The narrator in the post-apocalyptic period found the translation and began to transcribe it into the writing of her own community in this futuristic world.
That third translator is the one Shelby says she relates to the most. With waves of history in Boyosa's work, the pressure is to keep everything as true as possible, to protect ancient stories while at the same time giving them another way to live. And Will says that new life doesn't stop with the translated edition. He credits Alamo Drafthouse Cinema's model of promoting and experiencing films as his inspiration, and looks ahead to Deep Vellum's ongoing partnership with the theater chain.
How do we make the experience of reading and like discovering books and being around people who also love books more fun and more engaging and something like that's really rewarding and something that's sustainable into the future?
For Monocle, in Dallas, I'm Lindsay Connect.
Interesting times in Dallas. Thank you very much, Lindsay. I'm here with Anne Meadows and Izette Verhagen, and we're trying to wrestle with the question, why are books in translation such big business? We've got a little bit of time left for a couple more questions. While that tape was playing, I was wondering about whether this charge of translated fiction is bossed by the big boys, the large publishers, or actually whether it's kind of a bottom-up movement, and whether people, this proliferation of work in translation comes from some of the more boutique publishers.
I think it's both. I mean, there are publishers like Harville Secker, which was originally an independent imprint or two independent imprints and is now part of Random House, and Maclehose, which is now part of Quercus Books. And those publishers, and particularly Christopher Maclehose, have been publishing works in translation brilliantly for years and years and years and years and years. And they had the success with the Stieg Larsson Millennium Trilogy, you know, which really buoyed, I think, translated fiction in the UK and got a lot of people reading. But then in the last 10 years, there have been all of these passion projects, and Stefan Tobler at And Other Stories is an example of this, and Jacques Testard at Fitzcarraldo Editions, who have been completely unafraid in trying new models even of translated fiction, going direct to translators and saying, what do you want to translate? And going to readers and saying, what are you interested in? And I think as well that Twitter gets credit for almost all social revolutions, but I think that the translation community, meaning both readers and translators and small publishers working on Twitter and on Facebook to talk to each other and really champion translation, has really driven things. And I should say as well, you know, my company, Portobello Books, we were founded in 2006 with the aim that a third of our list every year, 33%, should be translation. And we've done that every year. You know, there are a lot of independent publishers out there who are fighting and will keep fighting, and it's just lovely to see it working.
Lizette, does that sound like a familiar story, that it's a sort of bit of both? You need the big boys to kind of muscle to the top of the bookshelves, but actually the interesting stuff is often done by these smaller publishing houses.
Absolutely. And what I think is really funny to see now, or a really interesting movement, is because of some smaller press who are getting really, really successful in translation, now the bigger publishers are now doing or trying to do the same. So one of my favorite publishing houses is Pushkin Press, because they do lots in translation, and they find a way to also be not like too experimental, or they really go for really, really good storytelling. So that really shows that there is another side of that translation doesn't have to be super serious. They're not really commercial, but they have like a very good feeling what people want. So I think that's a really good publisher that I think a lot of other publishers are following.
Nice. It's fascinating times in the world of translation. Before you go, I'm going to get you both to give a recommendation. Anne.
So obviously, The Vegetarian has just won the Man Booker International Prize and, you know, been feted with press, and you should all go out and buy it. But I'm actually going to recommend a book called My Brilliant Friend, which has been the big translated success of the last few years, but it's been almost entirely driven by word of mouth and by passion. And if you haven't read this book yet, you must. It's an extraordinary Italian writer called Elena Ferrante, who we've mentioned a few times in this program. And the novel immerses you in this down and out world of Naples in the 1950s. And these two girls, these very young girls, one of whom is educated and one of whom is not. And the question really of the books is, what is brilliance and what does it mean to survive in these conditions of poverty? And I mean, they're epic sagas really, but incredibly pleasurable and beautifully written.
Sounds beautiful stuff. Lizette?
One of the books I'm looking forward to is Milena Busquets. She's a Catalan author, and she comes with the book This Too Shall Pass. And it was a huge, had a lot of buzz, I think, two book fairs ago, I think in Frankfurt. I can't remember, but I remember that everyone was like talking about the book, and it takes a while before the readers can really read it. So now it's our turn that we can buy it. And there was so much buzz around it that I definitely wanted to read it. I don't know if I'm going to like it, but it's definitely... Everyone is talking about it. So that's This Too Shall Pass.
And the internet sets on fire with the sound of people Googling those books. Thank you both very much indeed. Lizette Verhagen, international rights agent at David Godwin Associates, and Anne Meadows, commissioning editor at Granter and Portobello Books. Thank you very much indeed for chewing over this thorny, horny old subject with me. Thank you very much. That brings us to the end of today's Culture Show. Thank you very much to my guests today. You've been listening to Culture. My producer was the best-selling Holly Fisher. Join me again at the same time next week. But for the time being, I've been Robert Pound, and thanks for tuning in.